borders, Vermonters, come down with your breeches of deerskin and jackets of brown, with your red woolen caps and your moccasins. Come to the gathering summons of trumpet and drum. Come down with your rifle, let gray wolf and fox howl on in the shadow of primitive rocks. Let bear feed securely from pig pen and stall. Here's two-legged game for your powder and ball. And cheer, cheer, the green mountaineer. And cheer, cheer, the green mountaineer. On the south came the Hessians, our land to police, and armed for the battle while canting of peace. On our east came the British, the red-coated band, to hang up our leaders and eat up our land. Oh, all to the rescue, for Satan shall work no gain for the legions of Hampshire and York. They claim our possession, the pitiful knaves. The tribute we pay shall be prisons and graves. And cheer, cheer, the green mountaineer. And cheer, cheer, the green mountaineer. We owe no allegiance, we bow to no throne. Our ruler is law, and the law is our own. Our leaders themselves are our own fellow men, who can handle the sword and the scythe and the pen. Hurrah for Vermont, for the land that we till must have sons to defend her from valley and hill. Our vow is recorded, our banner unfurled. In the name of Vermont, we defy all the world. And cheer, cheer, the green mountaineer. And cheer, cheer, the green mountaineer. And cheer, cheer, the green mountaineer.
Kevin Annett, welcome back. It is March the 5th, and that song, The Ballad of the Green Mountain Boys, goes out to a group of faithful listeners outside Burlington, Vermont. Yes, we love that state. It's the only state in the Union ever not to have slaves, and also the first state to bring in a law prohibiting property qualifications for voting. So the legacy of liberty lives on in Vermont. Thank you, brothers and sisters. We're here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, at www.itccs.org, murderbydecree.com, or our websites. And if you don't know by now, we're here leading the campaign for common law republics and using those republics as our weapon against the corporate tyranny that is enslaving or trying to enslave our planet. We started with the campaign to expose genocide, moved on to also confront the biggest institutions of slavery in the world, starting in Rome and the Vatican. Now we're spread across the planet. We're taking this message everywhere. So please tune in every Sunday. Today we are continuing, as promised, our educational series on the roots of genocide. The last half of the show will be lecture number 3 that yours truly gave in 2002 in Vancouver. And we've done a lot of exploration and learning since then. So there's things said there that have been updated. You can see a lot of the updated evidence at murderbydecree.com and our other books at amazon.com. Today also, in the time before that next lecture, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about something that's been in the news, and we're going to get to that in a minute. It involves a mass grave in Choom, Ireland. That's on the west coast, and the massive spin operation that the Catholic Church and the Irish government are doing right now, an operation that's very instructive for all of us, because this is a perfect example of how the powers that be operate to hide their crimes. Going to get to that in a minute, but first a few announcements. As you probably know, as we've heard before, our book number 11 for yours truly is out this coming week. It's the Common Law Training Manual, Restoring the Rule of Natural Justice, a Common Law Training Manual out through Amazon.com, looking into the history and the roots of the common law, how to set up common law courts, your own peace officers, and all of the other details of how you need to operate on any campaign, on any issue. So watch for that at Amazon.com. We'll also put up a notice about it at ITCCS.org. Now, coming out of that manual, there be plans, especially in Canada, over the next month, to hold workshops based on the manual. One attempt to do that will be held in Toronto. They're having a meeting the evening at 6 p.m. They're doing a potluck and then a mini workshop and an organizing meeting at an address in Toronto. That's March 16th, which I believe is a Thursday. Thursday, March 16th. If you're in the Toronto area or anywhere in southern Ontario and you want to take part in that, please write to us and we'll send you the information. That's Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata@gmail.com. And related to that, of course, is another plug for the folks in eastern Ontario and the Ottawa-Belleville area who need your support. Write to the same address as well if you're in that area. They're trying a number of projects there, and we need to back them. So today on Radio Free Canada, this has been in the news, and it's a great concern because it involves mass murder of children, of course. Now, you might have noticed over the last couple of days there was really a rehashing of an article that came out in June 2014. And it's involving the discovery of over 800 skeletons of babies, that is, children under the age of three, and in some cases, the skeletons of fetuses. And these were discovered in a massive cistern, really a sewer, at the former Catholic orphanage called the Bon Secours, the Good Help Catholic orphanage. Well, the only thing they helped themselves to are the lives of these innocent children. And what came out 3 years ago now almost was the fact that since 1925 and right up until the 1970s, and possibly beyond, these children's bodies were dumped there. And from eyewitnesses, they saw that the children in this Bon Secours facility were underfed, were dying of malnutrition, children as young as 2, 3, 4 years old. Now, what we've established through our own inquiry into this is that there were two things going on there. This, from sources inside the Irish Garda, or the police, who came to us during that same summer from our contacts in Dublin and on the West Coast, we learned, and let me just read to you from my book Unrelenting, because I quote one of these Garda officers. He said to us, quote, "Forget the cover story. Those little bones were cut up and burnt. We found skeletons that were missing their skulls, taken clean off, and they were nowhere in sight. I was told by forensics that these are all the signs of human sacrifice. Our examiner said he'd seen the same thing on the bones at a satanic ring burial site outside of Waterford that he'd analyzed. I mentioned this possibility to my commander, and he got extremely pissed at me and said never to mention that again if I wanted to keep my job," unquote. Well, that was back in the summer of 2014. It was interesting it came out then, because if you go to the itccs.org site, our tribunal website, and just plug in the search box June 2014, you'll see a number of articles that come up, including an offer that was made by the ITCCS central office in Brussels for amnesty to any insider in the church or state anywhere who could provide information that would lead to the uncovery of burial sites or the killing of children. Now, what's interesting is that very same month, really the same week, a number of women came forward. A woman called Catherine Corliss, who was a resident of Tuam. It's spelled T-U-A-M, but pronounced Tuam in Gaelic. Catherine Corliss, a resident of Tuam, did her own exploration, and she and some of the kids in the neighborhood discovered the cistern and the skeletons. She began to do her own research and found records of 796 deaths in the local archives. Now, as soon as that hit the Irish newspaper, the Irish Star and the Irish Independent, the government and the church, the Catholic Church, moved in quickly. They roped off the site, even though it was an obvious potential crime site. The police were not brought in officially, and the whole thing was just shut down. Now, the next year, the Irish government announces, and this is quite funny because it has, tragically funny, it has all the same markings of the so-called Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada. That is, the government and the church is responsible for the crime, get together and investigate themselves and give themselves blanket immunity. In the spring of 2015, the Irish government sets up what they call the Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Investigation. And it's run by, guess who, Yvonne Murphy, who is a judge who ran what was called the Murphy Inquiry that pretty much exonerated the Catholic Church back in 2009. It was a kind of a PR operation, which allowed the Catholic Church to avoid prosecution of any kind and just gave a very generic and general description of crimes the Church had committed. But there were no, as with the TRC in Canada, there was no legal consequence anywhere for any of it. Now, this new inquiry, so-called inquiries that they've set up, get this. There will be no police investigation of the site, even though they found bones, and in many of the cases cut up and signs of obvious foul play. No police investigation. No criminal charges will be laid. There will be no forensic examination of the remains. No subpoenaing of any records from the Roman Catholic Church, and no redress or compensation for any of the families. So call that a not just a whitewash, but a massive obstruction of justice. That's what's going on right now. But what was interesting is the way they've spun this whole thing, because all of a sudden in the press, they're repeating the story that came out almost 3 years ago as if the discovery had just happened, when in the background what you see going on is this rewriting of the whole narrative so that it looks like there's an investigation going on when it's, in fact, a toothless investigation. If you go to the site of the commission, it's, if you have a pen, write this down, MB for Brother HCOI.ie. That's MBHCOI.ie. That'll give you the whole site. Under terms of reference, it almost reads like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Basically, they're just in a kind of an academic inquiry where they're looking into things, but there will be no charges laid. It's no kind of criminal investigation. Also, what's interesting is they admit, and this leads into the second aspect of what this crime was really about. They admit that over 60,000 babies passed through this system, not just at Bon Secours, but 13 other homes run by the Catholic Church all over Ireland. And in many cases, these children were transported, and that's the word used by the Commission of Inquiry. They were transported out of the country to families and other agencies, in especially in Canada, interestingly enough, and America. In other words, child trafficking. And this is something, of course, that the Catholic Church is very notorious for. We know the present Pope Francis himself, as Archbishop of Buenos Aires, trafficked children of political prisoners for the military hunter all during the dirty wars in the 70s and 80s. And that's one of the reasons he became so high up and became Pope one day, because he was a loyal accomplice of that. The child trafficking going on of political prisoners' kids in Spain under the Franco dictatorship. I've met with survivors of that. The children who were sent into good little Catholic fascist families when they were young. I've met survivors in Barcelona and talked to them about this. In Spain alone, the Catholic Church trafficked over 300,000 children and made something like $20 million out of it, just of that one thing. Well, they did the same thing at these homes in Ireland. So in effect, when you're talking about these skeletons, little infant skeletons, what they are the remains of are two things. A child trafficking network which needs to supply young babies at a young age. It's also a satanic ritual repository that whenever they needed kids for these ritual killings, the Ninth Circle, they would go into these homes and get them. And it's interesting that Tos Nienhaus, one of the Ninth Circle survivors who was raised in the satanic cult, describes as a child and a teenager being taken as part of these rituals to the west coast of Ireland to former Catholic orphanages. So put two and two together, and clearly this is all the markings of the satanic ritual killings. But it wasn't just the killings. The second aspect that we're talking about, the child trafficking, what they do is they get a quota every month of certain number of children they need. What do they do with the surplus? Well, like in the residential schools, if you've got too many kids around, too many mouths to feed, it's costing the church money, and you can't have that, so you kill them off. You kill them off through exposing them to tuberculosis, like in the residential schools, maintaining a monthly death quota to keep the hungry mouths down. And these death quotas have been proven. They were even referred to in some of the documents that we actually submitted years ago, but we've never seen again, to the government, the TRC, in the early years in 2008. These monthly death quotas, they needed to bring down the number of hungry mouths, and this is exactly what happened. The eyewitnesses at the Bon Secours home describe children starving, being weak and emaciated, and wearing rags and being sick all the time. They were starving them to death. They were killing them off when they couldn't sell them overseas. When they couldn't traffic them, they were killed off. And that's the evidence. Now, not surprisingly, the churches and government now are making the whole thing seem benign, like they did in Canada. You know, the genocide without a consequence, the guilt-free genocide we have in Canada, where 65-plus thousand children can go missing and die. Nobody ever goes to jail about it, and the official society thinks it's been resolved with an apology and a bit of money. So the same process, what we're seeing is another tip of this iceberg, and that's what's coming out this last week in Ireland. Now, there's a big groundswell of opposition to this in Ireland. Unlike in Canada, people go to the streets over in Europe when children are ritually killed, when they're raped, when they're trafficked. We had in Brussels alone a number of years ago, I think it was around 2004 during the Marc Dutroux trial, there was almost 100,000 people in the streets protesting the serial killer Marc Dutroux and his proven ties to the royal families of Europe and their involvement in these ritual killings of children. Something, again, confirmed by Anne-Marie van Bielenberg, one of our witnesses, and you can see that at itccs.org. So people are up in arms in Ireland now, and there's a real demand for a people's inquiry outside the government and the church-run thing. Not just inquiry, but, and here's where the common law court thing comes in, the power to press charges and make citizen arrest. Now, there was an attempt to form a common law court in Galway in 2014 that we tried to set up. It was shut down through after Sean Brady, the Cardinal of Ireland, was forced to resign because of our exposing of his involvement in the Tuam killings and his covering up and forcing children in that area to sign statements saying they were not raped by priests. After that was exposed, Cardinal Sean Brady stepped down. Who replaced him? Dermot Martin, the Archbishop of Dublin, who conducted a massive smear and misinformation campaign using church money all over Ireland. It attacked our activists in Galway. It shut down any media coverage of what we were doing. And that went into abeyance, all of our work there. But it's rising up again. And there's people now wanting, because of these revelations again in the press, wanting to get up and get the Common Law Court of Galway going again so people can go in there and start arresting those responsible and shutting down this murderous child trafficking church, which, under international law, is a transnational criminal organization because the Roman Catholic Church traffics human beings, launders money for criminal organizations, has a long history of genocide. It doesn't have the right to legally operate or morally operate. So that's something very relevant to what we're doing in Canada and all over in Kanata, because we've moved past the point of documentation and education and mere protest. We're now setting up other institutions to bring down these criminal bodies and to set up a new common law jurisdiction, a sovereign jurisdiction under the sovereignty of the people themselves. Now, you can read about the basis of all of that in the upcoming book, The Common Law Training Manual, murderbydecree.com. Follow a lot of this at itccs.org. And today, in the lecture series that we're going to play in a few minutes, I go into more of the historical background about how and why this came about in Canada in the 18th, 19th, and end of the 20th century, leading up to the residential school crimes. We need to know this background. Simple fact, people say, well, why does this keep happening all the time? How come these churches can murder like this and once again get away with it? Well, not only because the government are their partners in crime, but it's a very simple rule that for elites to rule a majority, they have to demonstrate that they have a monopoly of violence. And they do that through arbitrarily reaching out and killing on a regular basis. They show people that we have the power of life and death over you, and there's nothing you can do to stop us. Psychologically, that reaffirms their rule, their hold. And there's continual examples. It happens in war. It used to happen through public hangings. Now it happens through these institutions where they literally get away with murder. Now, a slave or a child cannot conceive of stopping the master, the parent, the ruler from hitting them. They just say, well, please don't hit us so badly. And that's what people say all the time when they say, well, we need a government inquiry so there can be an apology and a bit of admission. Well, you know, they can admit and apologize all they want, and they're going to do it again tomorrow. Because in the words of Sean Brady, the cardinal, he said the only reason there should be an inquiry into these crimes is to spare the church scandal. That's his attitude morally. It's not about the children were killed or there's a problem with that. It's that it caused the church to lose money in public standing. Now, their image and their money is all they care about. And as we often say in our books, including the other book you should grab, A Manual for Whistleblowers and Truth Tellers, there's two things big institutions like churches and governments fear, and only two things that will stop them. You threaten their money and you threaten their public image. And that's what you do through these common law courts, through the direct actions where you're arresting their top officers, which any of you out there can do, but just don't ever do it alone. Go in numbers. Document it. We find groups of 3 to 5 are good because it doesn't look like a mob, but it's small enough and big enough so that they know you mean business. And these kind of action groups are being trained as we speak to go in and shut down these people responsible. That's the only way we're going to save the lives of these children. So take this to heart. We're going to be doing more of this in future shows, actually. We're going to be bringing on veterans, including, for example, the folks in Pennsylvania who have actually set up home rule charters, devolving power back into the community to stop fracking in their case. But it can be applied on any issue. We're going to be bringing on more people to talk about how to set up these home rule charters, the common law courts, and the other ways to stop these folks and the ones that are continuing to get away with these crimes because we are letting them. We don't have anyone to blame for but ourselves. The fault is not in the stars, as Hamlet said, but in ourselves. And we have to overcome that through education, determination, and constant action. We need new priorities in our life. And if anything, the events in Ireland this week are proving that once again. So, once again, tune in. I'm going to go off the air in about a minute, and then we're going to hear our lecture series number 3, and get all our works. Put my name in, Kevin Annett, at Amazon.com. You'll see all of our books come up there. Order them, get them into your communities, especially Murder by Decree, which you can see online, murderbydecree.com. And keep writing. I appreciate all the feedback we're getting. And one woman wrote to me, and she said, "You're a lifeline. Keep it up." Okay, well, if only for you, we'll keep it up. But I know there are many out there who think they're alone. They may be in all sorts of prisons, but those prisons don't exist when we have liberated our minds. And I want to finish with a wonderful quote from by Samuel Adams, the incendiary who led the American Revolution. He said, "It does not take a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority, keen on setting brush fires of freedom in the minds of the people." And that's what we're doing, setting brush fires of freedom in the minds of the people. And Marcus Aurelius, who wrote in the Meditations, said, "All that you need to be upright, just, and courageous in this life, you have within yourself already, that fragment of divinity that the gods have given each person to guard and to guide them." Well, folks, may that fragment of divinity lead you this week and make you act on what you know is true in your own conscience, in your own community, and from what you read and are inspired by on this show. Thank you. We'll be back next week, same time. Hope you enjoy the lecture. Until next week, stay strong, stay clear. Thank you.
Well, welcome again. Lecture 3 in our series on genocide in Canada. For people who are new, last week I was describing how the culture of genocide based on the notion of Christian superior dominion, that is the right of Christians to dominate other people, how that took hold in North America. And I began to describe some of the ways that it started to happen in Canada during the battle in the fur trade between the French and the British in the 1500s. Basically, last week was describing how a combined holy war by church and state conquered what is now Canada during the 15th and 1600s, during that protracted struggle over the fur trade. And even though England formally won this war, the regime that was set up in Canada actually solidified the power of the Roman Catholic Church in Lower Canada, or what we now call Quebec, and the monopoly of a similar monopoly by the Anglican Church in Upper Canada, or what is now Ontario. Not only, and this is significant in terms of looking at the development of genocide as pretty much a religiously led movement in Canada, because not only did that power block in Upper and Lower Canada continue to rule all of Canada, but after the defeat in 1837 of the attempt by various forces in Canada to happen here what occurred in the United States, that is, achieve a democratic system of responsible government. After that was defeated, the 1837 rebellions were defeated. Basically, political evolution in Canada was frozen, and what was set in stone were feudal and colonial institutions, which I described last time. For example, the vestiges of which we still have, the lieutenant governor and governor general system, which is a colonial system where those officials are not accountable to the people of Canada but to a foreign monarch. the judiciary state-appointed. In B.C., where criminal charges are laid directly by the Attorney General's Department rather than an independent police force. These are all vestiges of a colonial system. And at the heart of that system was the absolute power of the churches in English and French Canada, and basically the control they had over Indian affairs and ultimately the lands and resources. Now, this control by the churches has pretty much been lost. If you look in the media today, whenever they talk about residential schools, the line that's been spun over the last 7 or 8 years, that is since the lawsuits began against the churches and government, has been pretty much that the residential schools were a government idea that they recruited the churches into. In fact, a lot of the evidence that I've come across, both documentary evidence in Indian Affairs archives and also eyewitness testimonies, say exactly the opposite, that in fact the whole residential school came out of the missionary effort, which was very much dictated to by the government, to the government by the churches. Now, tonight I want to look at the context in which genocide occurred in Canada in the 18th and 19th centuries. These were the centuries in which the outright extermination of the majority of Native nations in Western Canada occurred. When you're looking at genocide in Canada, you really have to make a distinction between the East and the West. Very different dynamic going on. In the East, of course, as we talked about already, there was the power struggle between the French and the British created a certain advantage among Native nations who allied with the British. We know that today, I have an interesting anecdote about that the power that the Mohawk and the Iroquois and the Six Nations Confederacies were able to gain because of their alliance with the British. I went to the Ganawake Reserve west of Montreal 3 years ago to give some talks. And the Ganawake Reserve is one of the largest in Canada, and it comes from a time when the Mohawks were given that land by the British with the recognition of the fact that they had the absolute title over that land. And that was a reward for their help in the French and Indian Wars. And what was interesting, when you go on that reserve, you go into the main hall in the Ganawake Band Council, and you have pictures of all the chiefs up on the wall posing with all these prime ministers. So it kind of exudes a sense of these are not folks who feel crushed. They have a sense that they're on parity. They're on equal terms with the government. And what was interesting was the most important picture on the wall that was kind of surround at the center was actually some chief shaking hands with Tommy Hunter, you know, the singer. So I kind of found that interesting that we're prime ministers and Tommy Hunter ranked in the scheme of things. But there's a very different dynamic in the East than in the West. By the 1800s, when the missionaries and the CPR was moving west, the policy of the government was pretty much one, as in the United States, of some of outright occupation and marginalizing Native nations immediately onto reserves. The Eastern Aboriginal nations had acquired some influence because of their alliance with the British. Of course, those who weren't allied with the British were, like the Huron and the Algonquin-speaking people, faced outright extermination, as did the Eastern Maritime nations like the Beothuks. One of the things that are continually cited these days in the Native Sovereignty Movement and among people fighting around land claims is the Royal Proclamation of 1763. You hear that cited a lot. This was a proclamation by King George III honoring his Mohawk allies by stating that they had control over their own territory and that any white person who wanted to come in there, any non-native, had to get their authority before they could do that, and that the Mohawk land could not be exploited in any way without the permission of the Mohawks. Well, what's left out of that analysis is the fact that there is, as I mentioned last time, there was an implicit understanding that, nevertheless, all land reverted to the Crown. That is, it was all land in Canada was named as Crown land. In effect, the Mohawks and others covered by the Royal Proclamation were simply administrators of Crown land. Now, that's very different. When you're administrating something owned by the Queen, that's very different than saying, this is our land, we have absolute root title to it. So I think that's important to keep in mind, that in the British administration of Canada, there was always first the understanding that this is all Crown land, and this continues to be an issue in land claims struggles today. In other words, like the Christian religion itself, the British Crown had a monopoly over Indian life, and they couldn't even conceive of there being an alternative of Indians not being dominated by the Crown or by the Christian religion. And yet, that kind of condescending dictatorship, in effect, has never actually recognized Aboriginal sovereignty in practice. On the contrary, and this is very important to remember and to learn, that the British administration, both then and now, created a whole language of doublethink which created the impression that Indians were actually prospering under British rule and were masters of their own territories, when in fact exactly the opposite was the case. The British actually perfected that ability of psychological control over the people that they had conquered to such an extent that by 1750, like the Romans, they were very effective in co-opting various indigenous nations into the administration of empire itself. The Spanish would slaughter the indigenous people. The British incorporated an elite within native culture into the actual administration of the empire. So successful was the strategy that by 1750, if you can believe it, one quarter of the world's population and one third of all trade and commerce in the world was controlled by the British Empire. That's the higher percentage than any empire has ever had in world history. One of the reasons they were able to do that, and India is a classic example of their ability to divide and conquer and turn one local prince against another. They did that all over the world with indigenous people, and the most effective way they did that was by convincing one element of the indigenous leadership that they had to actually not just ally with the British, but become part of the colonial state, the administration of the ongoing genocide. Now, we have examples of that ongoing. I just saw something on the internet the other day where there's a big debate and controversy breaking out in the Assembly of First Nations. Because Phil Fontaine, who's resumed the leadership of that body for Matthew Cuncombe, has announced that he wants $1.7 billion more dollars from the federal government, and he's going to create five new commissions dealing with land claims, native investment, native health. And in effect, he's creating a new bureaucracy within the AFN. And some, including some BC chiefs, have said that all Fontaine is doing is beginning to administer programs for the federal government rather than actually being able to, articulate the actual demands and needs of Native people from the grassroots. So this shows you that this whole strategy of incorporating Native leaders into the state is not just a recent thing. This was established by the British as part of the way that their empire operated. Now, this strategy of dividing and conquering the Indian nations became entrenched in Canadian politics after the power sharing that I mentioned between Catholic Lower Canada and Protestant Upper Canada. After that was established after 1763. What was interesting, a lot of people don't realize this, but after the Plains of Abraham, when the French were supposedly conquered, the British actually turned over much of the functioning of society in Lower Canada to the Catholic Church. And, for example, the Catholic Bishop of Montreal was given literally absolute power in return for his public statements of allegiance to the British Crown. So, for example, during the American Revolution, the Bishop of Montreal actually excommunicated any citizen who would not take up arms against the American revolutionaries. And the same thing happened in the War of 1812 when the Americans actually invaded parts of Canada. The Catholic Church in Quebec was a recruiting sergeant for the British. And in return, the Catholic Church literally had a total monopoly over French Canadian life, which continued, like I mentioned, right to the Quiet Revolution in the 1960s. In fact, so allied was the Catholic Church in Quebec to the British Crown that, in fact, the first experiments in residential schools were started by the Catholics in Montreal in the early 1800s at the request of the British Crown, who wanted to make the, quote, surviving savages good citizens. And so the Catholic Church began to experiment in that, where they would take children and put them in these Catholic schools and only let them, force them to speak English and that kind of thing. Now, within British Canada, the same kind of religious monopoly was exercised, but by the Anglican Church of England. Until well after Confederation. As a matter of fact, right into the 20th century, no other church but the Anglicans was allowed to legally practice in Upper Canada or Ontario. The Methodists, the Baptists, Presbyterians, Quakers, all of the churches that were not tied directly to the state were forced to the western regions of the country. And in fact, that's why so many of the missionaries in the West were from those denominations. That's why they were, for example, here on the coast, the Presbyterian Church was very aggressive in setting up residential schools because they didn't have anywhere else to go. They could only operate in the West because of the monopoly that the Anglican Church, the state church, had in Ontario. Now, the point of this power sharing, of dividing up the country religiously that way, was obviously it had an economic motive. The British Empire had to exploit the vast resources of the New World and also create captured markets for British goods in Canada. But also, and this was really clear when you look at the correspondence of prime ministers and other government people, they were very afraid of the Republican example to the South. And they wanted these loyal populations as a bulwark against the Americans, who, as you know, were continually trying to encroach, the slogan 5440 or fight, where the Americans wanted to extend the border right up to the 54th parallel, which I think is somewhere around the Haida Gwaii, that far north in British Columbia. So clearly the British had different motives in creating that kind of monopoly over society, but it was clear that from the beginning it was a religious empire. The notion that the conquest of Indian people was not only for the sake of uniting the country under the British crown, but also forcibly converting them to Christianity was part of that whole arrangement. Continually in church missionary documents, when you read them, you see this, the reference to Christianizing and Canadianizing the population. The two go hand in hand. Christianize and Canadianize. So very nationalistic and very Christian all along. The notion that there's somehow a separation between church and state is really not really present in the evidence when you look at it. There was from a very, very beginning the notion that church and state were working hand in glove in this effort. Now, after the British had hanged the ringleaders of the 1837 rebellions, people who had simply tried to bring responsible government to Canada, they created something called the Act of Union in 1840. Now, this set up, this is the British Crown recognized the existence of different societies. The notion, the phrase equal but separate French and Canadians, French and British societies within Canada. These societies were both the same, really. They were hierarchical colonial systems of power run by the bishops in Quebec, Anglican administrators in Ontario, and run pretty much in the interests of not only the British Crown, but a very small class of wealthy merchants like the Hudson's Bay Company, and particularly the railway companies, which more and more played a major role in Canadian politics in the 1800s. And the most clear example we have of that is John A. Macdonald, being at one time lawyer and major shareholder in the Canadian Pacific Railway, basically helping to instigate the Métis Rebellion in Manitoba in the 1880s, right at a time when the government had cut off all funding for the railway construction. It was stalled somewhere in Ontario, and John A. had to find a reason to continue the construction and get his fellow CPR shareholders back on the government payroll, basically. And that's a whole separate story, but it was interesting the way that he played such a obvious role in the interest of the railway company. Now, the attitude of this class towards Indians continued to be that if the latter would not get off their land and become Christians, they were to be eliminated. Of course, using the polite doublethink of British colonialism, this policy wasn't called genocide, but rather civilizing. Today we call it assimilation and multiculturalism, but behind the misleading language has always lay the reality of ethnic cleansing in Canada. Genocide in Canada, in practical terms, meant forcing Indians to surrender their land and identity and to be moved into internment camps called Indian reserves. This policy was clearly laid out in one of the foundational documents of genocide in our country, a thing called the Gradual Civilization Act, which was passed in the Upper Canada Legislature in August of 1857. So this is before Confederation. The Gradual Civilization Act applied to all remaining Indians in Canada, and it declared that such persons would remain legal non-entities with no guarantees or protection, even for their safety, until they had surrendered their land title and become what was called enfranchised, that is, landless, deculturalized persons. In effect, the British Crown was saying that it was open season on Indians unless they got off their land. And yet even so-called enfranchised Indians were not to be granted the minimal rights of a citizen. Enfranchised Indians, once they had surrendered their land title, would still not be able to vote, could not hire a lawyer, or even appeal the actions of the government or of non-Indians in a court of law. So once a native person had given up their land, if somebody came along and robbed them or ripped them off in some way, they couldn't go to court over it. They were literally non-persons still within society. Enfranchisement meant cultural extinction, which is always the precursor to physical extinction. And that's important to remember. You've got to reduce people to the condition of a stateless person without rights before you can physically exterminate them. And we have the most recent example from Nazi Germany to show that. Now, sure enough, within about 50 to 60 years of the passing of the Gradual Civilization Act, hundreds of thousands of Indians died of smallpox and other diseases on reserves and in the residential schools across Canada, simply because they had been forced off their land base, the thing that gave them health, the traditional way of life, which was maintaining them in their traditional societies, and had suddenly become stateless, landless persons who were completely at the mercy of the colonial governments. Now, this genocide steamroller was slowed somewhat by the Métis rebellions in Manitoba in the 1870s and 80s, and the quasi-recognition Ottawa had to grant to this group of native people who had taken up arms against the Crown. But elsewhere, the eviction of Indians from their land as a step in their physical extermination proceeded pretty much unchecked across Canada. This genocide was enshrined in the Federal Indian Act, which was passed in 1874, another very important document, because it still serves as the basis for all Indian affairs in Canada. It's been amended time and again in the 80s, in the 1920s. In the 1930s, the Indian Act was amended to allow the RCMP to operate as the police arm of the residential schools, where, in fact, RCMP officers were made, in effect, truant officers for the residential school to go out and empty the villages of kids and hunt them down when they ran away. But the Indian Act itself, originally, was directly modeled on that Gradual Civilization Act and all of its assumptions. That is, Native people were non-persons, even after giving up their land. In effect, the Indian Act created Indians in a separate legal category, as a separate class of people, who were deemed not to be able to govern themselves, and in effect, who were reduced to legal wards of the state. Now, in other words, the legal status of Indians defined by the Indian Act as wards of the state was the same as that of children or of incompetent adults, such as mental patients. Now, wards of the state, under the law, have no separate identity. They cannot act or speak for themselves. They cannot own anything or appear in court on their own behalf. They can't vote or attain any status in society. And yet this is the exact condition of Indians in Canada under the Indian Act. To quote a leading Anglican church official in 1910, quote, "The Indians are savage children who need to be raised in a civilized environment. Without Christian instruction, they should be considered no different than the wild beasts of the field or the deranged man incapable of rational thought," unquote. So without going to residential school, you're essentially an animal. And you know what happens to animals. In fact, during the formulation of the residential school's legislation in 1910, the Anglican Church successfully lobbied the government to define non-Christian Indians as mental patients under the law in order to allow their wholesale incarceration in residential schools under the control of a single official. Now, the Catholic Church did the same thing in Quebec with the Duplessis orphans, which you may have read about, where they emptied a lot of their orphanages and put the children in insane asylums in order to get more money from the government, essentially. And by doing so, by redefining natives as mental patients, this legal definition allowed not only their incarceration in residential schools, but their legal sterilization. Thousands of Native men and women were sterilized under sterilization laws passed in 1929 in Alberta, in 1933 in British Columbia, the same legislation. And this legislation, if you know anything about the eugenics movement, was first developed to apply to mental patients to stop them from breeding. It was developed in the 1880s and 90s in the United States, Adolf Hitler picked it up, but it was really an American invention. And it was extended to include not just the sterilization of mental defective people and physically defective people, but socially, but so-called socially and morally defective people, for example, runaway children, unwed mothers, and natives who were considered incompetent because they weren't Christians. They weren't fully developed, you see, so they were like children, and they could and should be sterilized. A lot has been written on this. One institution in Alberta specialized in this, the Provincial Training School in Red Deer, Alberta, and the Pinoca Mental Hospital in Pinoca, Alberta. Monday magazine actually ran a series of articles on those institutions and how they had a policy of blanket sterilization of all of these groups, including Indians. And when I lived on Salt Spring Island 3 years ago, I actually interviewed Pat Taylor, who was a nurse at the Red Deer Hospital, and she confirmed that they would gather in kids off the street, and as soon as they reached puberty, the 100% of them were sterilized as a policy. So this was as recently as this practice stopped in the 1970s, but it shows you that this eugenics mentality was widespread, and of course Indians weren't the only targets, but they were certainly considered a prime target because they were considered culturally and mentally defective people, simply because they weren't Christians. Now, one of the litmus tests of the intent to commit genocide by a regime is this kind of systematic reduction of a targeted population to the status of slaves within their own country. Like the Jews under the Nazis, Indians in Canada were segregated and enslaved prior to their outright extermination, at least in the West, where the majority of non-Christian Indians survived until in the 20th century. That is, they were legally enslaved and socially isolated in order to be more effectively exterminated. The fate of the remaining free Indian nations was sealed after the defeat of the Métis rebellions in 1885 and the completion of the Canadian Pacific Railway the following year. The lands and resources of the West were suddenly opened up to European conquest, and so a quick and effective way of removing the remaining Indians had to be found. Well, enter the RCMP. The Royal Northwest Mounted Police were created the same year, in 1886, and they were formed with an explicit mandate to clear a swath of land 50 miles on either side of the Canadian Pacific Railway and to maintain this area free of all Indian nations. So in effect, as an arm of the state, the RCMP worked closely with the main practitioners of genocide, the missionary churches, which had penetrated the West by the 1850s and begun to create the conditions for the wholesale confinement and eventually extermination of non-Christian Indian groups. As I mentioned, under the Indian Act, RCMP were actually made an arm of the residential schools. And it was kind of like a tag team cooperation going on between church and state, which pretty much became the norm. This was clearly displayed not only in the continual efforts of Indian agents to cover up the huge number of deaths in the residential schools of the children there and on the reserves, but in the actual fusion of the functions of church and state in the missionaries, especially in the West Coast. Now, I discovered a very notorious and an instructive example of this in the case of John Ross, who was a Presbyterian missionary sent out among the Yahoussit Indians of Vancouver Island in 1903. I found a lot of this correspondence right in the UBC Library in the Indian Affairs Archives. John Ross was made an honorary magistrate by the provincial government at the same time that he arrived as a missionary for the Presbyterians. And as such, he was empowered to set up special one-man courts to try and imprison any Indian elder he liked, such as elders who refused to surrender their land or to send the ones who wouldn't send their children to the residential school, which he had established on Flores Island, which is in the Clayoquot Sound north of Tofino. Ross used this power of church and state rolled into one person to even create a private police force of native constables and, in effect, create a mini-theocratic state among the Yahoussits between 1903 and 1915. Under Ross's reign of terror, the Yahoussits were driven off their ancestral land and eradicated as a people. The percentage of Yahoussits who were Christians rose from under 1% to nearly 80% in just 10 years because traditional elders were killed, brutalized, and evicted from their homes by Ross's police force. Outright terror by a church armed by the state clearly worked. And after Ross's example, the churches and government set up residential schools all over BC that were modeled on his practice. In effect, widespread terror used against people to force them into these schools. Now, terror against the West Coast Indians was also very profitable. Ross forced the Housed Elders to give to his church, the Presbyterian Church, one-third of their richest timberlands on what's now Flores Island. And when the Presbyterians joined the United Church of Canada in 1925, this church inherited all of the stolen land of hundreds of acres of red cedar old-growth trees. Now, eventually, in 1953, the United Church sold the stolen land back to John Ross's own grandson, Hamilton Ross, who just happened to work for McMillan Bloedel, the largest logging company in the province and a major contributor to the United Church and to the Vancouver School of Theology, where I trained as a minister. It was actually my discovery of the secret deal in 1994 that led to my immediate firing by the United Church. And I think that's an interesting statement about how the continual colonial triangle between the government, the state, and the corporations continues to run our province and determine our treatment of Indian people. Now, as the 20th century dawned, about 95% of the Indians here on the West Coast had already succumbed to smallpox and other diseases. And I gave you the example, I think, previously of my friend Harriet Nahani and her village of Clouse that went from 3,400 people down to 44 in two generations because of smallpox. That's about 98.5% of people who died. Now, when you look historically at when the residential schools were created, it happened at the low point in the native population, where it looked like native people were about to be exterminated for good. And the strategy, of course, was to take that remnant and to put them in a controlled situation, that is, not just on reserves, but in these residential schools, where the last vestige of native culture would be eliminated from the minds and the souls of these surviving native people. But it was more than that. The more I look into it, it was clear that part of the plan was also to create a long-term death of non-assimilated Indian people simply by putting them in conditions of long-term landlessness, disease, and poverty. In effect, genocide, as it evolved in the 20th century in Canada, assumed a three-stage process. First, outright occupation and biological warfare, which happened through the smallpox and tuberculosis. Second, containment and control through the reserves and residential schools. And finally, systematic eradication caused by substandard conditions of life. And all you have to do is go down to Hastings and Maine and look around and you'll see the effectiveness of that strategy, where the Globe and Mail even in 1997 said that if you gathered all the native people in Canada together as a nation, they would rank 54th in the world in standard of living below people in Brazil and Thailand. When you look on reserves at the level, of course, AIDS is skyrocketing on Indian reserves, but one of the things I discovered in Port Alberni as a minister, much to my shock, was the extent of child infant mortality in the reserves. In the area around Port Alberni, the New Chalmers Health Board that worked for the Tribal Council told me in 1993 that the infant mortality rate among Housed and the other native children in that area was similar to the same rate of Guatemalan children in the highlands of northern Guatemala. So it shows you that third world conditions are persisting. And again, this is not accidental. This was because of a system set in motion well before the 20th century. Now, the key to this three-stage process, and this is, I think, one of my main points, the key to this three-stage process of genocide was creating a system to legally cull down Indian numbers and imprison the remnant populations in permanent conditions of sickness and destruction. The system was found in the Indian reserves and the residential schools. I'm going to be examining the details of both of these systems next week, but for now it's important to note that both the reserves and the residential schools were actually inspired, created, and maintained primarily by the Christian churches and their missionaries, rather than by the government, which mostly acquiesced to the plans of the churches when it came to Indians. As I mentioned, this is a radical idea these days in Canada, since for the past 7 years we've been hearing on the media this constant refrain that it was really a government idea, the residential schools. That's the most false and historically revisionist idea that's come along in a long time. And all you have to do is read through the archives in UBC for an hour to get the real story of how time and again the government was making the argument that there's no purpose in the residential schools. It was causing real division within Native society when you don't allow the children to see their parents for a whole year, where they don't learn traditional skills, how to fish, how to hunt. I remember one letter from an Indian agent even referring to the residential school system as insane, because all it did was create long-term problems in native society. But then the response by the local Catholic bishop was, but if we don't make them good Christians, they'll remain savages. And the response again of the higher-ups in the Canadian government was, just let this carry on. After all, the people in government were good Anglicans and Presbyterians. And simply acquiesced to the plans of the churches. Now, not only the residential schools, but Indian reserves in Western Canada were modeled on something called the Duryea system. That's D-U-R-I-E-U. The Duryea system was a plan to remodel Indian culture devised by Catholic Bishop Paul Duryea in 1882. Duryea lived in British Columbia, and he actually set up something that copied the early Jesuits in trying to create many Catholic states within Indian society, simply by eliminating all Indians who weren't Christians and then raising the Christian Indians to permanent and unnatural positions of power in the native world. The Jesuits had tried this in South America, in Paraguay, and in the 1500s. There was actually a movie made about this called The Mission. And it actually glorified the Jesuits there, where it actually made them look like allies of the Indians who were resisting slavery. Now, to some degree, that was true. But the Jesuits' plan in doing that was simply to find a way to effectively restructure native society so it was a reflection of the Catholic Church. Now, this system was tried successfully all over BC by Catholic missionaries. We have an example. I actually, on my radio program last year, I interviewed a man, Jerry Capilano, who was a descendant of a traditional elder from the Squamish Nation on the North Shore. And Jerry described how in 1920 the Catholic missionary and the Indian agent arrived at his grandfather's door and literally evicted the man out into the snow. And the house was reoccupied by a loyal Catholic native family. To this day, the people who run that reserve are descendants of those Catholic Indians. This was a practice done all up and down the coast. Traditional native elders were evicted from their homes. Some, according to a house of elders I've spoken to, claim that they were even poisoned and otherwise neutralized. And Catholic Indians, who were always men, were named by the missionaries the Grand Tribal Chief, an absurd practice in a traditionally egalitarian and matrilineal society where women tended to be the chiefs, but one which continues today on every reserve and native organization in Canada. Phil Fontaine is referred to as the Grand Chief, a totally unnatural and ahistorical designation within Native society. It would be comparable to say we now have the Grand Chief of Europe representing all Caucasian people. I mean, but that would be absurd because there are many nations within Europe, just as there are many Native nations within Canada, but suddenly we have a Grand Chief of all of them. Well, that was, again, not just a colonial invention, but something that came out of Bishop Duryea and his system. Now, when the Protestant churches and the federal government saw how effective the Duryea system was, they got fairly jealous and they began to immediately adopt these methods, including when the Indian Act was formalized in 1884 and the first state-funded residential schools were started in the 1890s. Now, the underlying assumptions of the Duryea system survived in the practices in the residential schools. Indians were all to be made into Christians without exceptions, and they were to be legally imprisoned in church-run schools and reserves administered jointly by the church and the state. Now, this was a system where special permission in the form of passes was required by any Indian to leave the reserve. Passes obtainable only from a missionary or an Indian agent, where no Indian could hire a lawyer, resist a law, or practice his own language or religion, and where children could be systematically exposed to communicable diseases, sterilized and killed at a rate of 50% every year for decades, with the full knowledge and active collusion of every institution in Canada under the authority of the churches. Clearly, Christian superior dominion had found its logical expression on Canada's west coast by 1900, where timber and gold had replaced furs as the motive force behind Christian invasion, but where the ideal of making all people Christians as part of their enslavement by a master race remained the hope of every true church person and their allies in government.